you are co-host.
Oh,
Ah,
I can record. That's surprising.
that's great.
But
Okay.
do it at your end as well.
Yes, sir. I think I got it. I think I got it. Is it recording? It's recording. All right.
All right.
All right. Welcome, everyone, for this Canadian Patriot podcast, where I'm very, very happy to be joined by Jason Horsley, who is a very, very fascinating figure in the literary commentary, philosophical analysis world. It's very difficult to plug you in, Jason. It's difficult to find a label for you. So maybe I'll ask you as an early question for you to do that for yourself. How would you describe yourself, Jason?
Well, I make it difficult, Matthew. I'm constantly changing personae, really, and websites, you name it. I've just constantly, like a moving target. It's partly conscious or deliberate in that way, because I don't, who wants to be a target, right? Just keep moving. But it's also compulsive. I'm always changing my angle of approach. Existential detective is a term that I stole from a movie called I.R. Huckabees, which is fitting because movies were my first in, really, as a teenager into kind of looking more closely at our culture, and they continue to be very central to what I do. But also, yeah, this term existential detective kind of covers everything. I'm trying to find meaning. I'm trying to find meaning in the world, in the chaos, you know. Reorder my senses and reorder the evidence in such a way that it corresponds more closely with reality. And so that, I think, obviously intersects with parapolitical analysis, if you want to call it that, which I know that
Yeah.
you do. I mean, looking at the ways in which our society has been covertly engineered and so on. I mean, that's been consistent through my work. So, yeah, essentially, I'm, you know, a multimedia communicator who is hell-bent on just trying to uncover my own psychic deformities, you know, to resolve and heal what was done to me by looking at the world, the hidden aspects of the world.
Yeah, that's very well said. And that's, I guess, the most honest way of doing it, right? From the standpoint, not of just trying to pretend that we're outside of the system, looking in, trying to make sense as if we're these observers from above, but rather we're shaped by the system that we were born into. We're trying to make sense of the world. How did it become this way? How do we account for our own turmoil? How do we become what we ascribe? I mean, everyone's body. Everyone wants to have a healthy body, but we also want a healthy mind and soul as well, hopefully. And so that requires a lot of introspection, in sort of this two, and that's what I love about your approach. When I read your essays, you've written a lot of books as well. I mean, your list is long. And for those who would like to look more into your work, buy your books, I'm going to suggest to go to the description box under this video, The Vice of Kings, Dark Oasis, Big Mother. There's a lot of books that you have, and a Substack, which is a very, very fruitful Substack. All of these things will be things that people can find in the description box. But your language that you take is subjective, but not in a way which is, I guess, for lack of a better word, manipulative. Like, I don't feel like my emotions are being manipulated by listening to you going through a subjective journey as if you're trying to take me to some predestined place dishonestly. You're making your thought process as transparent as possible as you're grappling with various lines, various beliefs, structures that are promoted by certain powers that be that want to nudge society in a certain direction. So I was wondering, how did you come about this method? Were you somebody who was originally in more of a mainstream writing world, and then you became more politically conscious, more self-aware? Or do you feel like you jumped right into your world as an existentialist detective, with that moral sort of searching from the get-go?
It was from the get-go. Although I was trying to enter the mainstream from a young age, as in what I wanted to make movies, and then I started writing, or at least my first published writing was about movies. So I always kind of had an eye on the mainstream. And there's also something in my family background which might pertain to this question. I'm not exactly sure how, if it does, but that I was, as Vice of Kings writes about, I was raised in a power family of entrepreneurs and political movers and shakers on my father's side. And although I wouldn't say I was obviously groomed for this, because it wasn't obvious at all, but nonetheless, I was raised in that environment. So there certainly were some expectations. And I inherited quite a lot of money, which I disinherited in my early 20s. So it's as though there was a kind of family cultural conditioning or priming to be more mainstream, if you will, although my family weren't actually that mainstream in many ways. They were quite unorthodox. But anyway, there was something that was pushing me into a more established kind of role in the world, in society. But I completely rejected that in my early 20s, and literally in the case of the money. So yeah, there was a period where I was trying to find a way into society, if you will, a role for myself, and I thought it was to do with filmmaking. And then it all the bottom just fell out, and so I ended up. It was almost a literalization of the spiritual path, like disinheriting my fortune and going off to darkest Africa to seek nothing really. I mean, just to see if I could survive, essentially. But I was aware that it was a tradition. I was aware that this was a spiritual tradition, but that wasn't my motivation. My motivation was simply to get to the truth of myself and to let go of the things that I was relying on to support me, because I knew that they wouldn't, right? So it was a way to try and survive. And I think, I mean, when you were introducing this subjectivity that you talk about in my writing, there's two reasons that I'm conscious of including it. Obviously, there would be unconscious ones too, but one is that I want to be honest and remind the reader, the recipient, that this is all subjective. So any of my analyses, they're always going to be filtered through this lens of my own subjective thing. And so to give the recipient, the reader, an idea of that lens, so they can more easily separate, right, the material, the evidence I'm presenting from the way I'm shaping it. That's number one. And number two is, if you want to make a case for whatever it is, in my case, organized malevolence, throughout the centuries, you need examples. And what better example than oneself? Like, one knows oneself from the inside and the outside. So I have I at a certain point in my writing, anyway, I started using myself as an example, and that happened to dovetail perfectly with becoming more conscious that I was writing to try and resolve something in myself. So when you were hinting at me being prolific as a writer, I was tempted to say what I say often, which is, I can't stop. If you can help me to stop, I'd be happy, but I'm compelled to write, and so that
It's
has to.
funny because I remember you. I listened to an interview that you delivered not that long ago, where you described how you would finish writing what would be your last book. You're done writing books. And I could feel that that probably wasn't going to be true necessarily,
Other
because you
people
could
can
see
see
that there's so much.
that, you see,
No, I've made similar commitments at different times as well, and it's like there's this thirst for the soul to discover and to share what it discovers. Because when you discover things, it's like a food for the soul. But then when you discover it, you can't just it's like eating an energy bar. You can't just eat the energy bar and just sit there. You got to do some work with that energy. And you gotta run, you gotta burn, and that's part of the sharing process, finding a way to craft, to create a language that will allow this which is within to be received in other souls around and about us.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I find it fascinating that you've your Substack is titled Children of Job, and in reading your about us, the purpose, the what you were thinking about when you made the Substack was that you had felt that you had finished sufficiently mapping hell, and now you're moving to a new phase. Could you say a little bit
Yeah.
about how your philosophy of mapping hell was provoked? Why use that language? I'm not against it. I think it's a fascinating language, and but
Yeah.
why use that, and what is your new shifting of gears right now into living through, I guess, the spirit of a character like a Job, from the Bible.
Yeah, a character who's in hell, but at least getting an audience with God. You know, his hellish situation is driving him to demand an audience with God, and he does get it in that book. So that is quite a good correlation with my felt experience, which is that in order to really find that within me, which is able to reach out to God, to the divine, to reality, to ultimate truth, whatever we're going to call it, because nobody wants to have an encounter with that, really. You know, if we're honest with ourselves, I have to really feel the absolute agony of being separate from that, which is being in hell. So that's, I'm going right to the end of the thing, as in how the transition from mapping hell to the latest thing is, you know, that's where I'm at, where my focus is moving away from hell, even though I'm still in hell in quotes or not in quotes, to what that sense of being in hell is pushing me towards, which is this encounter with God or this audience with God in the Jobian terms, but I'd say, you know, with one's own soul and authentic nature. But your question was, oh, the mapping hell, yeah. So that's an example of kind of what we've been started right away talking about or around is, you know, why do we write? And how I would say, I mean, certainly for me, but I would think for anyone who's really writing in the way that you were just talking about, you only discover why you're writing or how you're writing or even what you're writing later. You don't start thinking, I'm going to map hell now. Here's book number one. Like I only realized, well, with 16 Maps of Hell, obviously it's in the title. By the time I was writing that book, I was becoming more cognizant. Okay, this is what I've been doing, or at least this is a good way to describe it. And as to what it means, well, it was what I touched on already, is like there's a way in which, I don't want to say our or my, like, do I make it just personal? Or do I don't make it about all of us, but my slash our psyches, which at the deepest level is our souls, have been imprinted in a way that disfigures them. They've been traumatized, they've been fractured, but there's also an imprinting by the world, starting with our parents, because, well, starting with our ancestors way back, but, you know, at an experiential level, it's our parents. And then later we start having direct interactions with the world. And that is like a tattoo that scars us for life and mars our sense of our pristine nature. And so how do we, if not get that tattoo off, at least how do we see past it to what we are in our pristine selves? Well, to a large degree, you can't look at the psyche directly. Well, you can't, but if you see the analogy, I'm thinking of that movie Memento now. Actually, he's got tattoos all over, right, with telling him what to do. So that's kind of a bit similar. But yeah, you look, well, it's both to see the way in which the world, and this is the map of hell, is what I'm getting to, the world has imprinted us. You look at the tattoo as much as you can, but then you're also looking at the world, and then you're seeing the correlations. It's also like a it's like a teeth marks or something like that. It's good if you can get a cast of the psychopath who bit you, Ted Bundy's coming to mind, as well, to compare with these bite marks, right? And that, so that back and forth process that I already mentioned, that's what eventually I said, oh, that's mapping hell. That's a way to describe that that's just super simple. Admittedly, it then it's in a Christian context, obviously. I mean, it has that association as soon as you mention hell, but I was okay with that. Yeah.
I know that for people listening, they might be a little confused why we're beginning with these broad philosophical questions, but this is what I want, because I we are going to get into some details specifically on a wonderfully interesting analysis that you did of a book. But I really would like to just sort of set the stage a little bit, to provide for the spiritual, psychological environment in which this discussion and your words and thoughts and analysis have occurred. And as you were just talking, I was thinking, do I go straight into my first question about your book or my observation or your report, or do I follow something up? And I think I'm going to follow something up because I'm curious, subjectively speaking, since you are shedding light on a lot of those things that certain very sociopathic, powerful, multi-generational forces would prefer to be kept in the shadows, unknown to the vast majority of the people who are expected to believe in the mythologies crafted for largely their enslavement.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you are playing a role in transforming the conditions of this hellish state into something which is just and good? Or do you find that this is something that you're doing as a personal sort of homage or prayer to the creator, but that doesn't really have a power to disrupt or let's say free people from the sort of cage that they're expected to live in?
It seems a reasonable question. It's not either or, I trust. Mm. It's more about intention, that question, than actual result. I think the phrase that came to mind, and it's what I think, is that you can only lead by example.
Mm.
And that if I can free my own soul from this psychic enslavement of these falsely generated narratives that we've been imprinted with through traumatic engineering, trauma genesis, if I can free my own soul from that, obviously that's the prime goal for me personally. But I mean also, that how can I help anyone else get free if I'm not? It's like they say in psychotherapy, a therapist, not that I'm advocating psychotherapy, but you know, in its good manifestations, a therapist can only help a person to the level that they're at. They can't help them past that level. And there are levels, we don't know what they are, they're not mappable, I don't think, or they probably shouldn't be mapped, but there definitely are levels of awareness or wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
I could say my hope, but I think hope is a tricky thing, but my experience anyway, but it's also my hope is that by making public this process, not that I have any choice about it apparently, it can inspire and guide and inform others to their own process. I have, I mean, that's the much of the feedback, and generally the best feedback I've had has been people who've really zeroed in on the strange affinities, just how familiar the things I've been talking about are to them. And they will say things that are surprising, really, and I can tell that they're surprised, but like they just can't believe how, I mean, sometimes I get emails from people I don't know and they think I'm their best friend because they so much relate to what I've written. But of course I don't, it's a parasocial relationship, I don't know who they are, and you know, I don't know anything about them, but I do respond to that, the fact that if they've seen so much of their own process in what I've shared, then there's an affinity there, and what they're saying is that it's made them more conscious of something that they are undertaking or have undertaken without being fully conscious of it. They're becoming more conscious of it, and therefore they are getting closer to getting free. I don't think, to answer your question, I don't think it means that the whole world's going to be reconfigured into paradise. I think, you know, the social engineers and the fake narrative creators, that, you know, the devil on down, they might be kind of eternally installed in that role for all I know. I mean, certainly back 2000 years ago in the days of Jesus, that was what it was like. And now it's, you know, it's still like that now. So, you know, notwithstanding a second coming and, you know, the skies opening and a toll, right? the full apocalypse deal,
right.
I happen to believe is possible, but notwithstanding divine intervention, let's say, yeah, I don't see that we can bootstrap our way out of this, in that way, you know, a social level.
Yeah, no, I think that it's become a bit of a hokey thing to say, be the change you want to see, but it's so true. And it's in the sense that if you think about a process orientation that is not common, since our society is, I think, very inclined or conditioned to have a Hollywood romantic set of desires or expectations about the way the good will defeat evil or something within a 2 hour segment as I'm sitting in the cinema. We have all of these hokey expectations, but we don't tend to think of our life as being part of a process whereby we're given a certain allocation of time between birth and death. And like you just said, it's what are the choices that you're making in terms of discovering who you really are and trying to be a good example that will be an amplifier after you die towards something which will not be part of the problem. At the very least, who wants to be at the end of their life thinking, okay, I was part of the problem. Okay, now I'm gone. No, you'd rather try to, pursue truth, pursue the goodness, try to heal ourselves, and in so doing, become a role model that will be part of the greater good in the grand scheme of things, and not overstress the fact that we can't fix everything. Just like that.
I think it is tricky, the thing about being a role model, because I'm happy to be a role model, but not to see myself as a role model. And this is back to leading by example. Leading by example, I think, means that you're not looking for followers, and you don't even really know if you have followers because you're too busy trying to get where you're getting. But people can say, oh, look at that guy, he's going that way, and let's see, and then at a certain point, they're not following anymore, but they've actually found a way that is their way just by observing what somebody else was doing. That kind of leadership, because the orientation has to be away from hell, away from this world, towards God, towards goodness, towards the soul, towards life, if we keep it nice and secular. And that's it. Right, that's really it. So the car, it's almost as though that orientation doesn't leave room for anything else, including being a role model or making the world a better place. Or it's just so simple.
No, it's a good point. No, and the case of Job is a good one as well. Just being committed to your conscience no matter what, and despite what the world might expect of you, you're good with your conscience is the
Well,
key.
in the case of Job, and what I love about that story, it's even if God, he's saying even God, he'll even stand up to God if his conscience is telling him that God got it wrong. I mean, this is it's a bit of a head fuck, but especially because it's in the Bible. But it's the idea of God, of course. God, by definition, can't get it wrong, but we certainly can and will.
That's a good observation. Well, let's shift gears a little bit here, because you sent me a two-part series. This is something you had written back in 2019 and 2020 as a review of a rather influential book called American Cosmic by Diana Walsh Pasulka.
Had you heard about it then?
I had heard about her inferentially. I think I had watched an interview from her around that time, and she was making the tour of podcasts. I still see her now and again. I thought what you did was extraordinary. It was not your typical book review by any measure. What I was doing, I mean, at that time, I've been wrestling with the UFO mythos that's very pervasive in our generation, in our society. I'd been wrestling with it for some years. Back in 2003, 2004, I was really immersed in it, you know. I drank the
You're a
Kool-Aid. Oh yeah,
believer.
I was a believer. I was a believer for pretty intensely. And I revisited some of the paintings that I had done in art school at that time, and I did a triptych painting at the time of a Neanderthal watching some sort of a comet crash, and then a little take on the Michelangelo's David with an alien hand instead of God. I thought it was so profound. And then, the third one was like a businessman in our modern day being held by strings with like some alien hands above, And again, I thought it was the most profound thing that a 19-year-old student could come up with. And, in hindsight, looking back, I realized that it wasn't all that original. And a lot of those impulses didn't come from me, although if you asked me back then, I would have said, sure they did. These were my my insights. We've been obviously genetically modified. I mean, what else could account for the existence of this cognitive noetic species that we are? The Darwinian popular explanation isn't very satisfying, that we're just gradually, you know, moving from speciation to speciation gradually in time, and we were monkeys, now we're these cognitive humans. That's not satisfying. So of course, these discontinuous leaps could only be accounted for some form of alien species intervening to splice their genetics with monkeys to make humans. Of course, that accounts for the pyramids, and of course, you know, all that stuff. And I think I was reading some David Icke too, which probably
he doesn't have good aliens, so does he, David Icke? Usually,
no, he's taking the bad alien thesis. Yeah. They want to create.
I mean, were you influenced just by the X-Files, or were you also reading other stuff that? Because obviously, you just basically summed up the narratives there.
Yeah, I was reading a lot of magazines. You know, anything I could get my hands on that touched on it. I'm having trouble sort of recollecting specifically what it was. I wasn't very self-aware of my thought process at the time. So it's sort of like digging back into Shadowland a little bit.
It sounds like a trickle down. You're talking about a trickle down effect, probably, then, if you didn't actually go directly to her.
No, I think it was the environments, the circles that I was, you know, partying with, smoking weed with, and you know, you just have these conversations that just feed into, and it's the arts world too. So again, you're not always too self-aware. I think I had read the Celestine Prophecy. That was a big influential thing for me. All that to say, it was only after I began to become a little bit more geopolitically aware that I started holding on or revisiting some of these anomalies that I couldn't account for. One big one was, okay, well, if aliens did create early humans in that case, well, what created the aliens? Was it an older alien species that genetically modified them? If that's the case, what created that species? And you go on for an ad, you know, a reductio ad absurdum forever. So you're like, okay, there's some holes there. There's some holes also with the fact that crop circles seem to have been getting better. They only started being observed in the 1970s, and somehow they improved remarkably throughout the 80s and 90s in their craftsmanship. So you're like, if an intergalactic civilization of aliens were actually visiting us and communicating cryptically in crop circles, why would their artistic skills improve in such a small period of time? Like, that's weird. And then, of course, the geopolitical stuff started coming in when I started thinking a little bit more about the Rockefellers, the Rockefeller Foundation role in manipulating much of our history, and Lawrence Rockefeller playing a big role in creating the Disclosure Project back in the 90s, hiring people like Stephen Greer. So I began to, I guess, that helped a lot, pulling a lot of these anomalies together. But I still didn't quite think about it from the standpoint of parapsychology, all of this other weirdness. I wasn't bridging the spiritual aspect. I wasn't thinking about film so much and the manipulation or the crafting of new synthetic religions through this whole UFO thing. Whereas you don't seem to have had too much confusion about this. And it comes through very clearly in reading your assessment of American Cosmic, that you are very appreciative of the myth making and how aliens have been, or the alien mythos has been placed into the psyche over, especially this century, to bring about a new set of religions. You bring up Jediism as one of many type of alien cults or alien religions that have been synthetically sort of massaged. I was wondering, could you say a little bit something about what is it about Pasulka, who's a very influential person at the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion, and her book that made you think that this is worth taking my time to explore and to dissect?
Yeah.
Because it's not obvious.
Yeah, and why I reached out to you now, well, because the context now in 2023 was I just happened to hear through my wife and her Substack, she reads Rod Dreher, I think his name is. And there are a lot of people who are just discovering ufology now, it seems like. Mm-hmm. They're kind of coming to it fresh, but very naive because of that. So as soon as I heard that Pasulka had a new book out and that it was about encounters, I think it's called something like that, but it's about the way that entities might be interfacing with technology. I suppose in her language it would be ETs. I'm not entirely sure, but anyway, I kind of got activated, like Jason Bourne. It's like, oh yeah, my mission is to debunk these assholes. I'm so sick of this bullshit, because I do, I'm only human, and I just have a real visceral reaction against a certain kind of bullshit. But obviously it's particularly the kind of bullshit that I fell for. So like you, I was a big believer. In my case, it did trickle down, because we're just embedded in this culture. So for me, with hindsight, it was through David Bowie, Space Oddity and The Man Who Sold the World, those early albums, Ziggy Stardust, in which he was acting like an ET, pretending to be an ET. And that was in my adolescence that I got into David Bowie. That was also the first time I would have heard the name Aleister Crowley, probably. It was because it's in one of his songs, and there is a significant overlap there. But it wasn't until my early 20s that I discovered Whitley Strieber. In my teenage or my adolescence, I was into UFOs a little bit, but then I forgot about it. And then in my early 20s, I discovered Whitley Strieber through a UFO magazine in Mexico that I just happened to come across. And I was immediately like curious. And then I got hold of communion. And then I, as you used the cliche a minute ago, I drank the Kool-Aid, and I became convinced that, oh yes, I'm an experiencer, because I had these nightmares as a child. And so I got really deep into Whitley Strieber. Like, he was my gateway drug, and that led to a number of other books that I read, but mainly Strieber was my go-to. And he is a very interesting guy. I mean, his books have an interesting voice to them, and interesting, they're kind of unique. Anyway, so with Pasulka, I'm not entirely, I think I only heard about, I'm not sure how I heard about Pasulka. It might have been the Eric Davis podcast. But the thing was, is I'd already been hunting down Jeffrey Kripal because of his connection to Whitley Strieber. And that was the whole of Prisoner Infinity, which took several years to write, not because it took that long, but just because I kept leaving it and then coming back to it. This UFO thing, it's like a recurring nightmare, or it's like a comet or something. It comes around again every few years. But unlike maybe a comet, each time it's got a different angle or a different shape or different inhabitants or whatever you want to say. And so when I heard about American Cosmic, I was curious. And okay, what's going to be the take this time? How have they upgraded it? And then, because of the connections, as I cover in my article, her connections to Jacques Vallée, Jeffrey Kripal, and then later Edgar Mitchell, it's just the usual suspects. It's the same names. They come up, these generators of the narrative, these storytellers. But unlike the Tom DeLonge, Peter Lavender thing, which I couldn't even work up enough curious interest to actually delve in there. It just seems so unconvincing. This pop star and this
The secret machines
that thing,
series.
yeah. Unlike that, this had a sort of sheen of credibility to it. So I thought, well, let's give it a try. And I did find, that it was more rigorously done than previous attempts, so that got my curiosity more. But anyway, by the end of the book, yeah, I thought, I'm going to have to write about this, because again, there's so much naivete, and it's often hard to tell naivete from deception, or from, and because naivety can often be a kind of self-deception, and it's certainly hard to tell self-deception from deception. Is somebody who's just lying, or are they naive and they've been fooled? So with, yeah, the case of Pasulka, I didn't know, and I don't know, how much is she just being fooled and then becoming a useful instrument of these deceptions, or how much is she consciously partaking in the deception? And it's not either or either. It's quite a wide spectrum, really. And I don't say it's all deception either. There's definitely, as you mentioned, the paranormal. There are definitely aspects of this phenomenon that can't be reduced to a kind of advanced, Hollywood style psyop. nobody gets credit for, because it's not Steven Spielberg and Close Encounters. It's actually happening in the whole of culture. So it's not one movie. It's many movies, many books, many public figures, many pop songs, many TV shows. It's a meme. It's beyond a meme. It's a memeplex, I guess would be the term for it. And it goes back into occultism. So its roots are in theosophy and occultism.
And that's what I suppose makes it somewhat difficult sometimes to speak about these things rationally to others, because we're all, whether we know it or not, to varying degrees, saturated with this culture and all of these very influential artifacts that have been shaping the zeitgeist. That it's difficult to sort of, I don't want to use the language we use is limited, but to separate oneself from what is subjectively influencing how you're looking at the world, not what you think about the world in particulars, but like the filter around which you're looking at the world is itself got distortions that are built in by the movies, the as you pointed out, the parapsychology theories, all of this other stuff has been put into motion for a long time. So to talk about it, and then you get at the fact that okay, this actually is tied to things like the theosophy, 19th century theosophical motion processes that are directly tied to the all of these very influential things in our current world, it's difficult for people. So I think that you did a very, very good job as an introduction, at least, to help people think critically, because you're not passing any judgment against Pasulka. You're not saying that she's necessarily a liar, but you're just simply saying she's not persuasive and she's probably self-deceiving. At let's give her the benefit of the doubt. There's definitely major holes in the way she's formulating her telling her recount of her own experience, going from a hypercritical, overly critical, logical scientific thinker who doubts everything about the UFO mythos, to becoming effectively a full-blown believer towards the end of her experience that she's taking you through as this subjective journey. And you've brought up it, how it's difficult for people to judge lies. And I was thinking about a Fabian Society grand strategist by the name of H.G. Wells, who once said in his autobiography that one of the greatest things that the British Empire has to work with is people's unwillingness to think of evil. That was a very insightful observation that he made. And it's true, people will tend to reject thinking about a lie if it's being spoken in an authentic way. And let's assume that Pasulka is authentic and believes what she is saying. There's still Trojan horses being infused into the story that we're being taken for and living vicariously through the story that we're reading. How would you give advice to people to discern whether they are being manipulated in a dishonest way based on the type of story that she's recounting of her going from a scientist to becoming a believer? To the point of even this affecting her view of religion, ancient history. So, how would you help people sort of, what type of advice would you give people when approaching a story like hers, who, again, maybe she does pass all lie detector tests?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if she would or not, and I'm not sure if I'm in a position to give advice. Again, it's by example. I mean, well, it's interesting though, before I get to that, what you're talking about, that whether it's true or not, but again, benefit of the doubt, that Pasulka went from a hard-nosed skeptic to a believer. I think that that's kind of that is often the case with people who are naive, that somehow they think that their scientific rigor is enough to see them through this labyrinth, and it simply isn't. And so then they switch, right? Because the apparatus they have for analyzing the data gets challenged, they go far too quickly to a kind of woo position. This is the case of Pasulka, if she's sincere, because they haven't their scientific rationality has been based on such a limited data set that it's relatively easy to confound it, but confounding it doesn't mean that they've entered the realm of the transcendent at all. It could be that they just entered more sophisticated psychological operations by more intelligent people there than they are, so they can be tricked. Or it could be a metaphysical level, that there's a level of metaphysical deception that really does transcend rationality, but that doesn't make it benign, right? So those are two kinds of naivety. You know, one's a low-level naivety about political evil, let's say, and another is a more higher level kind of naivety, or more profoundly naive about metaphysical evil. So you know, maybe this is part of my response in terms of advice. The simple thing, like for somebody like Pazulka, is don't stop asking questions so quickly. I mean, to go from somebody who knows almost nothing about it to somebody who's more or less writing and talking like a believer, presenting these quite cogent but basically internally contradictory narratives meant to persuade others, that's really irresponsible. Like, this is a mystery that has confounded people for decades, just the UFO. But then if you track it back into occultism and then demonology, which she doesn't incorporate at all. There's no acknowledgement of demonology there at all. And
They're
yet she,
just the angels. They're just
yeah,
the well, yeah.
that's right. Is it, it so that, I mean, that kind of naivety is, I've got two thoughts at the same time, so they're going to cancel each other out. But so the one that I can hold on to then is this, if you are naive or uninformed or somehow closed to metaphysical realities, and you find yourself being open to them in certain contexts, in the case of Pazulka, it kind of makes sense that you would just go to the angels, because you're having to choose anyway. Like, okay, I have to now allow all kinds of new possibilities, but I don't like it. This is quite destabilizing. The last thing you want to start thinking about is the possibility of demonic entities manipulating you. You really are kind of fair game, or easy pickings, or fish in a barrel, what have you, for the angelic, the demonic deception of, trust us, we're angels. So that's, I mean, that's kind of just a condensed thing. Is if you're, people who are scientific rationalists, they are, it's not just that they're closed to metaphysical realities, they're also they're closed to ideas about evil and manipulation. I mean, it seems to be consistent. And these seem to become the best bellwethers or spokespeople for evil agendas, right? Because they have embraced the data, or rather, they've embraced the data that's been spun in a particular way to create a particular narrative in this very naive way. It's a disguise. It's a disguise for something else. I mean, the simple cliche, or well, cliche, but image for the UFO thing is a Trojan horse. This is the John Keel book, Operation Trojan Horse, a 70s UFO book, which is extremely good. I've no idea whether Pasulka's read this. I mean, there's so much. Even if you just stick to the literature, there's so many reasons that somebody like Pasulka has, or so many opportunities to thoroughly dismantle her own narrative, which is what you would do if you're going to be rigorous. If you're going to present an argument for the impossible, to quote, I think, is that Jeffrey Kripal? No, authors of the impossible, but anyway, it's close. Then you really have, that much more responsibility to try and disprove it, or to really dig very much deeper. And yeah, she simply doesn't do that. And that, but that is, I mean, to get to your question, the thing about the UFO, but all these things really, is they're never, you can't, there's never a point to stop and conclude and say, okay, we've figured it out now. It's not like that. It's like, I mean, they lead to a destabilization of our ideas about reality, and that's okay, that's fine, but not if you if you then cling desperately to the version of reality that's being given to you to rescue you from the destabilization, right? It's kind of the oldest con game in the book. As you take away people's felt, or their cherished idea of what's going on, and then you give them your version, and they will grab onto it, gratefully, particularly if it's kind of angelic and basically benign.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about because you bring up the Invisible College of Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée, that you make a point that this is important. It's not the focus of your review or even her book, but it's an important aspect. And I was surprised to find out that Jacques Vallée himself wrote a book on the Invisible College that he went through, that Alan Hynek, his mentor, had created, who's a very influential figure in the entire UFO mythos, from Project Sign and Grudge when he was a early astrophysicist working with the CIA on early UFO observations in the 40s, all the way through Project Blue Book. Alan Hynek was always there, going from kind of like Pasulka. His story is similar. He went from a hardcore, apparent, absolute radical skeptic, or so he said publicly, to becoming all of a sudden a completely devout believer who will talk about UFOs to anybody who will listen after 1964. And he creates this invisible college of parapsychologists, cyberneticists, and Jacques Vallée is a young hotshot who's cultivated within it. And there's this book by Frances Yates on the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, and she makes the point that the invisible college itself was a Rosicrucian operation, but that dovetailed these various British Royal Society empiricists who believed that the scientific method was purely reductive sense perception empiricism, and that's all we had for science. But then there's this whole spectrum of reality that cannot be accounted for by simply using your five senses and reductionism. And so they created this sort of almost lopsided hyper radical occultism that Descartes and Newton and so many of these empiricists all fell into the occult as well. So they were like walking almost in these two worlds. And people like Hynek, like Pasulka, they seem to sort of follow that model. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how the Invisible College played into your analysis, and this what is this as far as its modern incarnation that Vallée was a part of as the guide of this woman who wrote the book.
Well, I mean, I don't want to speculate too much. The Invisible College, it's a sort of contradiction in terms, isn't it? Because if it was really invisible, there wouldn't be books named after it and all this talk, and we wouldn't be able to identify their members and so on. Although I think it has a more benign description, like Marilynne Ferguson's Aquarian Conspiracy, the idea is, or Wells indeed, he wrote The Open Conspiracy, that anyway, well, I'll leave that aside. My sense of, or at least what I, not necessarily what I mean by the Invisible College, but what I felt was essential in that article was the social engineering aspects that surround the UFO narratives. I can't say the UFO itself, of course, but so for example, the Changing Images of Man document, that isn't directly associated with the Invisible College, but you might find some overlaps in the names of the people involved. That's the aspect that interests me more, because that seems easier to pin down, in terms of that there have been and that continue to be these semi-open agendas to direct society and reconfigure society around myths, around beliefs, around stories, including the UFO thing. That isn't what most of these authors mean or think they mean by the Invisible College. That seems to be more to do with the way that Pasulka writes about it. These scientists who are on the cutting edge of science, but they have to be secretive about it because they can't afford to compromise their careers and their reputations by talking openly about things that are not accepted by science. They have a few of these spokespeople who are willing to jump the shark and become public figures who, as you said, they were once considered hard-nosed scientists and now they're considered that they've gone native or what have you. John Mack was another obvious example. That seems to be closer to the official version of the Invisible College. And yeah, that overlaps with psychism, as Edgar Mitchell was very into both UFOs and psychism, or the hidden, human potential movement, as the Aldous Huxley phrase, Esalen, which overlaps with Jeffrey Kripal because he's the biographer of Esalen, tapping into man's innate psychic powers. It seems to be inseparable, really, from the ufology in this context as being this cutting edge of science that has to do with human potential. But I see. I don't, it, from what I see, it's impossible to separate those attempts, covert and open, to discover and harness man's psychic potential from the very darkest aspects of intelligence operations, MK Ultra, intentional traumatization of children through sexual abuse. And then, so then that overlaps with child sex trafficking and just everything. The absolute darkest aspects of human society are very closely running parallel to UFO phenomena and UFO research and just this whole world. And so bringing it back to this other question is, although I was saying, the people who are spinning narratives that are more or less tidy, as Pasulka or Strieber or even Vallée have done, can only do so by leaving out all of this dark stuff or a large amount. Jacques Vallée did acknowledge some of it. He was very good in his time, but something happened and his brain got replaced or something, because he went from being a very good, rigorous researcher to having, to just spouting the same party line bullshit. And but none of them, Strieber, a kind of partial exception, because he'll go into absolutely anything. Strieber's like the jack of all UFO trades. He'll cover just about anything if he can put himself there when it happened. But yeah, just about all of them do leave out intentional traumatization of children, trafficking of children, this MK Ultra, all that stuff. And as soon as you allow that in, particularly if you allow that there's an overlap between memories of satanic ritual abuse or suppressed memories and screen memories of apparent abduction, there's an overlap that clearly indicates that some people who have memories of being abducted by aliens were actually being traumatized by human beings. Right, the whole thing is blown out of the water. You can't imagine that as a footnote or an appendix in Pasulka's book. The whole thing is, it sinks it, right? Because you can't leave anything after that point.
And she consciously, as you pointed out in an interview, she made a point that when asked why didn't she look at the darker side of the story of ufology, she said, "Well, look, I've got five kids. I couldn't emotionally allow myself to go there. I'd spin out of control." And then she said, "And the other thing is, I'd probably also not have a secure position in my university job as well." And it's like right there, those are two really big weak spots that anybody who spends more than 2 seconds looking at this thing critically can see, as you just pointed out. MK Ultra, military industrial psychiatrists experimenting on people. There's an overlap of Satanists, so why? Why would you consciously just put all of that aside and only treat it from this one narrow narrative that this is actually angels,
That's
helping
it.
us?
The mind boggles, right? I mean, you could say at least she was honest, but I mean, she said that in an interview with Eric Davis, and he didn't take her up on it. He has his own affiliations, actually. He's understudied with Jeffrey Kripal. So, yeah, at what point does naivete become conscious irresponsibility, if not malevolence? It's a really necessary question, because if by being naive and by somewhat even intentionally and consciously ignoring certain facts, you become thereby useful for these very agendas that you don't want to include in your narrative because they would destabilize you and your reputation, then you are part of the malevolent agendas.
Yeah, whether you know it or not, eh? Well, yeah, the and The thing with the valet, I was reading his, oh, was it Passenger to Magonia or something? I forgot the
Yeah, that's one of
1969.
them.
It, right, it's where he like innovated the, I guess for the first official time, the interdimensional extraterrestrial hypothesis that the aliens are not actually from our dimension, but using quantum mechanics, we can postulate that they're actually from another dimension overlapping our own, and they have advanced technology, and that's what's been the elves and the angels and the everything that folklore from different cultures have labeled to be dwarves or something. That's actually been the whole time these aliens, and you know, so he sort of postulated that, but in it he also points out that his friend was Kenneth Anger. He's like, my friend Kenneth Anger gave me this advice. He also is hanging out a lot with Anton LaVey during this period too, which he says was just for research. So you got all these pictures where they're all like chummy, chummy beyond belief, and you got Anton LaVey's second in command, Michael Aquino, as well, who's working at Fort Bragg in the U.S. military industrial complex, working to bring in the parapsychology work from the SRI into reforming the military, or creating these Jedi special soldiers inside of the U.S. military in the 80s with his Mind Wars reforms. So you got all the
Yeah,
Satanism.
psychological warfare was his specialty, and he was named in ritual abuse cases, Aquino, and
All
daycare
these children
centers.
and daycares around the military campuses are all like,
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, something that Kreipl said, I remember in Jeffrey Kreipl when he, I think it would have been around the time of Supernatural, he was doing the circuit a lot. I don't know if he still is with alternate podcasts. And I remember him saying one time when somebody brought up Esther Lynn and the links to CIA, he said, "I don't do conspiracy." Right? End of subject, right? Like it was beneath him or something.
At least
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is
Timothy
why.
Leary is more honest. He's like, well, yeah, the CIA made drugs. That's why they're great. At least he could at least say it. Yeah, that's weird, eh? That they'll just not weird. I guess it's not surprising. What do you think about the you already brought up Aleister Crowley's, or these the admiration that Ziggy Stardust had for Crowley, and we see these Crowleyan networks and Satanists all over the place in this picture. What do you think of this? Like, how does your mind wrap itself around the influence of these Crowleyan Satanists throughout the UFO world and mythos?
Again, this is where it's, I think, more than helpful, but indispensable to have one's own experience to refer to as an example, because otherwise it's too broad, a question to try and contemplate. But if I just narrow it down to myself, it gets fairly simple. I was drawn to David Bowie, and then a bit after that to Clint Eastwood, and then a bit after that to Carlos Castaneda and Aleister Crowley, and then a bit after that to Whitley Strieber and the UFO, for all the same reason, which is I was looking for power, and I thought, knowledge would give me power. Knowledge is power. And God, I mean, you can see this written large now with these Marvel superhero movies, which have their own, obviously they have their dark side. But I also grew up, I left out Marvel superheroes because before David Bowie, I was raised or reared on Marvel superheroes. So that throughout my own personal formation, from very young to about age 6 to 26, let's say those 20 years, I had one myth of empowerment or another. Just take your pick. They were evolving and mutated, but there was this common thread running through all of them. And I think that many people, or most people, they don't really care where the power comes from as long as they can have it. And you see this also in the world in terms of ideologies that, like the whole woke phenomenon, which also has its transhumanist supernatural aspect. If you break it apart, it is also about superpowers and magical thinking. It's all baked into wokeism as well, and it's just so disconnected from reality. But the point I was going to make there is that essentially what seems to be driving all of these people, and I'd say all of us until we become conscious of it, is we want power. And if we can't get power for ourselves, we just want to get close to power and align with the power so we'll be safe from the power. Because we're basically raised, born and bred and engineered and traumatized in a world of a power abuse, where power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And those who have power abuse their power, and part of how they abuse their power is giving, power to, the power itself favors those who will abuse it. It's this system, it's this hidden power that's actually, where if you want to get more power, you have to abuse your power, and then you'll get more. Like it's that's the this kind of dark power that is running our society. So that's Crowley in a nutshell. Like he's a poster child for this. And in a weird way, that's illustrative also, like Jimmy Savile later on, who's not well known even now outside of Britain, but a very dark, predatorial guy who was very, very famous for 50 years and very highly influential and highly connected. But he was very open about it. Like Crowley bragged about how evil he was and called himself the B666. But somehow that worked to give him a more or less immaculate record for later. Oh, he's so cool, and it's so postmodern, and it's so ironic. He's just, I'm evil because you Christian idiots don't get that, real power is beyond good and evil. Which, I mean, some truth in that. That's the problem, is that it all gets mixed up. And Jimmy Savile, he was also very open about being a kind of a psychopath, but it was all taken as a joke. So we have these figures that have this massive appeal, just as the idea of the Superman slash ET or superheroes, has this appeal. We want to believe in it because we want to believe that we could be that. And it that's to me that's that is occultism. Occultism is the promise of power, like to have power over, it's power over demons, isn't it? But it's also like Jesus in the desert. Lucifer, Satan comes along and says, I'll give you power. I'll give you power to turn stone into bread, power over all the kingdoms of the world, and power to be lifted up by the angels. That's the temptation of Jesus, and that's what occultism is. Also in the Garden of Eden as well, eat of this fruit and all that, which isn't to say that power per se is bad, but the desire for power, it kind of guarantees that you abuse it.
Well, I think that the idea of Lucifer as a romantic character in our, you see it all over in Netflix shows and film and in a lot of things. Like there's this idea that of the rebel, a rebel against the establishment who doesn't want to abide by a rational duty or demands, but rather wants to like follow his passion. That's something that's become almost like a virtue, not almost, definitely a virtue.
Yeah, being an individual, of course.
And it's like there's an element of truth, like yes, establishment institutions have done a lot of harm. And sometimes we can do things that are objectively good, but for the wrong reasons. You know, the like the Jedi ethic in Star Wars. If you listen to the way that the reason why the Jedi order does good, it's very by the book, very formal. We must do our duty. There's not a lot of sense of loving the good or having some internal process that had you come to a love for truth and goodness, but it's rather you must be by the book. So that creates a very rigid, institutionalized order that one would kind of feel suffocated by. You'd be very sympathetic why somebody would go to the dark side where they could express their inner impulses that they're otherwise having to suffocate. But you almost have this stuff as a formula. And you point out in your essay that I didn't even know this, that Joseph Campbell not only worked on the Changing Images of Man team at the Stanford Research Institute under Harman, but also advised George Lucas
I don't think he advised him or just inspired him, but
or
so
inspired Lucas. That's
it's
it, yeah.
credited him, yeah. Credited him and Castaneda, actually. He said he was into the Force came from Castaneda, apparently, and then the sort of archetypal story came from Campbell. Yeah, I mean, this points to how large this is, but not in the sense of anyone you've heard of is in on it, although that's possible too, but in the sense that it's like a war of ideas, or like is this memeplex again, like how do bad ideas travel and how do they replicate? You could even say it's invisible entities that, like mind viruses, they infect us and then they use us to travel around, pass from one person to another. That would be an image there. But the thing is, yeah, the invisible college really is invisible. And it will use anyone that it can infect with these ideas, including you or I. And I very much was, some of my early books, I had to recognize I was actually regurgitating a lot of these ideas I'd got from sources that I eventually discovered were entirely dodgy, and some of them intentionally, and some of them not just useful idiots, but actually conscious agents of disinformation, I would say. But either way, you're taking on, bad ideas and replicating them and making them your own, in quotes, like you were saying with your art. I did similar kind of art, by the way, drawings and things, and had this similar idea. Yeah, it, as you said, it didn't come from me. I just became a carrier for it, and it hijacked and co-opted my own creativity, and used it to make itself, more original or more. This agenda, it can only proceed and succeed by recruiting as many creative visionary individuals as possible and duping them and tricking them into becoming servants of it. And yeah, in many cases I don't think they have a clue. And also, it's not either or. I mean, I wouldn't say that Joseph Campbell did necessarily more harm than good. He did both. Or Jung is another good case study here. There's an awful lot of good, I think, in Jung, but there's also he's been highly influential in ways you can see are not good, and this is so often the case. So there seems to be a, it's almost like a, it's like a blueprint somehow that's been created, and it probably is some sort of metaphysical entity grid or something that we can't see, whereby. If anything that becomes big enough in society gets naturally pulled into this blueprint and reshaped by it, becomes fuel for this overriding agenda. I can't remember what I'm answering with this point here, but
Oh, we're just musing about
was it?
Joseph Campbell's influence in shaping a lot of the fiction, the stories that are very
Well,
close to
also,
our
because
heart.
you were talking around the controlled opposition and the desire to be a rebel, which is a, you didn't mention controlled opposition, but I was going to, because it absolutely is a ver it is a virtue, I think, in the deepest sense, to want to be autonomous, to aspire to be autonomous, to have the courage to go your own way, and to not necessarily resist or even oppose, but to not submit to the controlling agencies and ideologies, and to actually be your own man. You can't achieve anything without that. So that rebellious spirit, you could say it's Promethean fire, it is the divine spark. That's how the divine spark was present. So it's the thing that's most essential to oppress. But if you can't suppress and oppress it, which you can't, because by definition it's life, then you co-opt it. You create these forms of expression. I mean, transgender is a perfect dark example, to lure that creative rebellion urge and impulse into. And people don't realize that the forms of rebellion that they're adopting have been given to them by the very powers that they think that they're rebelling against.
There's an interesting set of interviews that Joseph Campbell gave, and I'm sympathetic to him as well. I've picked up his Changing Images of Man, and I think, I think he's authentic. But there was this interesting, I think it was in the first interview, and he's speaking to someone who's very asking good questions regarding his thesis of the power of myths, and the interviewer has a Christian ethic about him. You could sort of see it in his language, and he's very fascinated by everything Joseph has to say, and rightfully so, because it's fascinating. But he brings up the example of Prometheus, Aeschylus's Prometheus specifically, and I found it fascinating to listen to Joseph Campbell, who had so much to say about every question before that. He would go off for 8-minute, really insightful responses on different elements of the universal archetypal properties of different stories around the different cultures and giving examples. And it was really interesting. And then he got to the answer to the question of Aeschylus's Prometheus that the interviewer threw at him, which is, I love Prometheus. I love Aeschylus's Prometheus. And I think that that actually is the most, one of the most important archetypes for everything good that has emerged over the past 2,600 years. Is this internal, it's almost what you described with Job, the internal impulse of Job just being so committed to conscience that he's willing to suffer, even if it, as long as it means that the health of his soul will be good. Because there's a higher just purity of a certain love of something better that is animating him than people who are on a lower epistemological level. But Joseph Campbell's response was literally 10 seconds. He just said, oh yeah, that's a story about an impish character who stole fire. And then he just changes the subject. Mm. He moves on. He can't deal. He was not able to emotionally go there to deal with what Aeschylus was doing with the character, and just dismisses it and goes to some other broader thing about demons running a race or something. And it just completely derails the conversation. But yeah, I just found that was very insightful as far as just hearing him fall apart.
Wow.
Yeah. Now the thing with the changing images of man, of the growth of Star Wars, did you ever see any connection to the I'm seeing a lot of parallels with L. Ron Hubbard and his cosmology that he put forth in his many science fiction books, and especially that's enshrined in his science fiction religious cult that he created right after Adamski was doing his thing with the Space Brothers. There's some interesting connections there, yeah, I think.
Absolutely.
But then all of a sudden he comes onto the scene as a follower of Crowley, creating this giant cosmology. Do you see any connection to the type of overlap that had with Star Wars, or is it just sort of a coincidence that I have of taking two things and sort of forcing them together?
No, but because if you take two things, it's a bit like you said about David Icke. He joins a lot of dots, but what about the dots in between that he skipped over because he was too eager to create a picture? Because if you have all the dots before you start trying to join them, you might find that the ones you joined wouldn't join, right? Because they have to go this way. Right? So it's a bit like that. Like, the Scientology really is written large on the cultural landscape, and so is Star Wars. So it's quite easy to connect them, but there's so many other examples that we're not necessarily acknowledging. Star Trek would be one that's also large, and that's around, predates Star Wars by quite a period. Star Wars wouldn't exist without Star Trek, I don't think. And a lot's been written about Gene Roddenberry and his connections, quote unquote, or perhaps without the quotes. But it's not about connections, as we've.
That was the one guy I was hoping maybe he was untainted by this
oh, yeah. No, there is no one. There is no one. Okay. But what I was going to say about this. It was William Sims Bainbridge, like, who I quote in this article. Most people never heard of William Sims Bainbridge, and never heard of Changing Images of Man, for that matter. But Bainbridge really has a low profile, even though he worked for the Pentagon. He wrote a whole piece about the Process Church, who I'm sure you've noticed they pop up a hell of a lot in these researches if you do them. And he was an early adopter of transhumanism and a proponent of transhumanism in a literal sense of uploading your consciousness into a cloud, and how space travel would depend on this. Like, space travel and transhumanism were kind of codependent, and both needed to be promoted in order to ensure the continuity of capitalism, for lack of a better term, but the power structures that be. Anyway, he did some research into UFO cults, as I quote in that article, and in Prisoner Infinity also. And his interest was simply this, that they clearly have the basis for a secular religion. And a secular religion is essential for two reasons I can think of. One is it doesn't depend on any kind of divine revelation, so you can just make it up, really. I mean, Mormon Church would be a really good case study here, because that's like more like Scientology than Christianity, I think,
Yes.
right? So that's one thing. And the other thing, what was the other thing? I've lost my thread. You have a course. Yeah, I've got a.
The extraction of the divine from the UFO cults, the idea of the malleability of it by a transhumanist overlord class that can just change it at whim.
Right. I guess that was, yeah,
Yeah.
it was the one. And the other thing is that because it centers around technology and because it's secular, it's much more easy to incorporate within, I don't know what adjective we're going to term, because capitalism is an old one used by Marxists, but the kind of hierarchical or consumer-based economic structures, admittedly, they're all being reset now, but I think basically on the same program, they're not really compatible with religious faith. I mean, you get more like a truly devout religious community looks more like the Amish. It certainly doesn't look like smart cities, right? So these are the two reasons, anyway, I would say, or there's probably many more, that he was interested in UFO cults and UFO stories and all the rest of it. And I don't know, as far as I know, he didn't write about Hubbard and Scientology, and I certainly don't think he wrote about Star Wars, but they would be completely within his realm of interest. And it's possible he didn't write about Scientology precisely because Scientology was a successful example of what he was talking about, and he wouldn't want to draw attention to it. But absolutely, because he was talking about it as an idea, like this could happen someday in the future. And even there, it was just that his books were never mainstream. They were reports for insiders, really. But so, yeah, I think Scientology is best looked at in this light, besides or including, its connections to occultism via Crowley and Jack Parsons, which obviously is a huge can of snakes. But in terms of it becoming fully functional, fully effective, I mean, it was so influential. I say was, because I think it's seen its time in the sun is done pretty much. But maybe I'm wrong. But in terms of how central it was in Hollywood, for example, and that's only one example, it was hugely influential, Scientology. And to this day, although it's been exposed countless times as an abusive cult, I don't think it's been very thoroughly revealed as being a psychological operation inseparable from intelligence operations, and starting obviously with naval intelligence that
Yes.
Hubbard worked for. It wasn't in the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, that's for sure. So it hasn't really been deconstructed, or but I think its time, it's probably outlived its uses to a large degree. And Scientology, it never had much prestige, let's face it. As influential as it was always considered in the mainstream as kooky religion that Tom Cruise belonged to. So that was always very limiting, and you can tell. You just have to walk into one of their churches or watch one of their promo videos. There's a lot of cheese, right? There isn't much. Apparently, it's not very sophisticated, but it is. But it's aimed for a certain demographic. What I think that they've been attempting to do for some time, and why American Cosmic got my attention, is that they are trying to upgrade this scientistic religion that centers around divine technology, which is an oxymoron, I think. What was I saying? They're trying to upgrade it, yeah, by improving the narratives and making them more and more reputable, less and less ridiculous. Because Scientology, it does look ridiculous. People believe it, but it looks ridiculous. The UFO for decades has looked ridiculous, even though all these supposed scientists are coming out and saying, no, take it seriously. They haven't somehow managed to make it in such a way that, I mean, it's a
That it
massive.
would become that there it always had a niche It lacks something that would allow it to be more universalized, I guess.
Yeah, well, it lacks divine revelation and it lacks scientific credibility because it's, well, because it's not the narratives. Like, if you're going to try and introduce a new scientific model for reality, like Einstein and whatnot, well, they had the bomb for that. I mean, they proved Einstein's thesis with a nuclear bomb, I guess. But anyway, certainly that took full hold. Like, nobody questions Einstein unless you're going into parapolitics. But with the UFO, it doesn't have, because the stories told around the UFO, and they try and fudge this by saying it's in that article, well, the UFO deliberately introduces elements of the absurd in order to prevent scientists from taking it seriously, or blah blah blah. Like, they're trying to somehow make the lack of credibility of UFO stories part of the interpretation of UFO, but it just doesn't work because, as I was saying earlier, if you leave out a whole bunch of data, you can't create a convincing scientific model. So people sense this. I mean, it has taken hold. Like you were saying about yourself as a 19-year-old, where did you get that from? You weren't exactly sure, but it's in the zeitgeist. A huge percentage of people believe, quote unquote, in UFOs, quote unquote. You can ask them that. What do you think about UFOs? They'll say, oh, I believe in them. You didn't even ask them if they believe. And then what they believe is they believe they're extraterrestrial, right? So it has taken hold, but it hasn't, it's in the sort of populace. It hasn't somehow managed to achieve this kind of stabilization of a consensus that they can start to regulate society around it, which is how they use religions. Have always been that. How do you order a community, right? Well, people have to believe it devoutly, and although people do believe devoutly in the ET, it's like Scientology. They're kind of a bit cracked, those people, right?
And that's where I guess the sort of punchline in American Cosmic with the story of Jeffrey Kripal, that was it, came into play towards the end when all of a sudden the journey shifts gears and they're now in the Vatican archives.
Oh, that's
And
Tyler. That's not
oh, it's
Christ.
Tyler, right? The character
Tyler. Yeah.
Tyler, right? I miswrote
Yeah.
that. Yeah,
Yeah.
right. He all of a sudden converts towards the end. This person who's on the inside knows so much about ufology and all of this stuff, and all of a sudden his decision to convert to Catholicism
Yeah.
speaks very loudly about, I think, a broader agenda and what type of effect they want to have both in their audience, but also on rebranding what Christianity was, the story
That's right.
that's animated us for 2,000 years.
Yeah, it's
Why
like,
build something new when you could just contaminate what already works as a mechanism of influence?
and it's like, I mean, sort of think of an analogy here. I suppose it's like when I was a kid of comic books. If you had two failing comic books, you'd combine them into a single comic book, and maybe you double your audience, and you can keep it alive. It's a bit like this. Like, the UFO potentially could prop up and inject new life into the Catholic Church, while the Catholic Church can lend credibility or reputability, seems hard to believe, but anyway, to the UFO narrative. But potentially, there's this idea that somehow, if you bring a scientistic narrative with a very old religious tradition together, they will, reinforce each other, and maybe they will. I mean, certainly there's a vast number of Catholics in the world, and you or I can't just dismiss all those people, and probably don't want to either, although I think the Catholic Church is provably worse than corrupt, as an edifice, a satanic edifice, I think, provably. So it's not doesn't seem a good idea to be a Catholic, but nonetheless, the beliefs that they adhere to are sourced in something that looks a lot like divine revelation. It seems real. There's a source or a root that's real. Therefore, you can't say that they're completely off track. And the same is true of the UFO. I mean, people who believe, quote unquote, in UFOs or take seriously these stories, they're not completely off track either. There definitely is something. It's not angels. So, well, I mean, even there, I guess you have to leave it open. It's certainly not only angels, let's say, or it's not primarily angels.
Well, there's definitely a desire to eliminate certain sets of ideas about God, the universe, and humans that have been troublesome to feudalists who really seem to long very deeply for some imaginary age of control and stasis where the masters knew their role and the slaves knew their role and the slaves were happy being slaves and the masters were happy with their orgies in their castles being masters. And there's certain idea sets that seem to be disruptive to that way of organizing society, which a lot of thought appears to have been put into amplifying disruptive or derailing the emergence of those types of troublesome thoughts that pertain to human freedom, that tend to emerge from time to time throughout history. Rarely, but when they do arise, they're very important. So yeah. To be able to create institutions of belief that that iron those out is a high priority for sure.
I think anything that preempts autonomy, essentially, I mean, if we're trying to crunch it down or reduce it to a principle, I mean, I'm interested by the framework that you just introduced there, and it's echoing what I said about religions being used to organize communities. I mean, that does start as something positive, and it doesn't depend on the suppression of autonomy. On the contrary, like a working community is a community of autonomous individuals who are following their own impulses and instincts, but in a way that's cooperative. And religion, in its true and its good sense, it is an expression of that, and it facilitates that because everybody is collectively oriented towards a higher good and a higher purpose, even if the belief itself is oversimplified. Nonetheless, it still represents something real, and if everyone has their own felt connection to the thing that's being symbolized or talked about, then they're autonomous and it works. But we've got, you know, we're this huge global village now, so we're so far from the simplicity of that, if it ever was simply working well, because as you're saying, in feudal societies, and what I've adopted the term aggrandizers from a book by Brian Hayden for my thesis in 60 Maps of Hell, there was from very early times, there's pretty much always been a certain type of human being who would exploit that situation and find ways to actually use the myths, use the beliefs, use the symbols and the stories to exploit others and promote themselves. So I thought I was going with this. I thought I was going somewhere more general. About autonomy. So I would say what the UFO has in common, or divine technology, let's make it broader, because you can see lots of people believe that technology is going to save them now, including this mRNA vaccine as a really big example. There's a belief that somehow technology is going to solve our problems. It's very widespread. So if you include the UFO in that, it's a much larger thing. But that what that has in common, this scientific belief in technology has in common with the dark side of religion, is belief in an external salvation element, which strips you of autonomy. Like if you need technology to save you, you're never going to be autonomous. Because autonomy means you have to be self-reliant to some degree. I mean, within the limits of your, you know, your part of nature, you can't actually be completely self-sufficient. Obviously, you have to eat, but you don't need all these different satanic sort of temptations and traps. And then religion, so I'm getting closer and closer to this with my Children of Job thing, and I even came clearer talking to you, that the God that is without you, that you experience outside of you, will always must always be placed second to the God that is emerging within. The God that you connect to internally always has to trump the one that you're experiencing outside of you, because the one that you're experiencing outside as an idea or as an image or as a community or as an institution will always be taking some autonomy from you, even if it's helping you find your autonomy. At a certain point, you can't find your full autonomy until you access it within you. So that's what these two things have in common, and that's the main agenda here, is lure people collectively further and further away from autonomy until they reach a point of no return where they can never get back to autonomy.
Right. And I guess that seems like one of the biggest Achilles, or one of the big Achilles heels with it, that the Catholic Church created for itself, was allowing, like, people, you know, they're it's very easy to find a lot of criticisms, rightfully so, for things like Vatican II, that conducted a lot of major reforms in the church, many of which we see now and were had a very bad agenda or insight to bring in wokeism, to overly liberalize the church. But at the same time, the problem was created from within the church anyway, by having only like a Latin liturgy that nobody understood, by having the priest turn their back to the people in the church when they're giving their sermon instead of speaking to the people. There was like a detachment from like God as the other, this overbearing thing outside of yourself that you have to be abide by and believe in and do these good things as rules. But then to be able to tap into the true reason why your heart would want to do the good, instead of just being told you must do the good and not really understand why, that created a severing of people from themselves. And that also created, I think, a severing of the clergy, of those who were supposed to be holy people, who found themselves more often than not, and it's disturbing, engaged in less than passions, less not so befitting of a dignified human being, let's just say that, which created this mountain of transgenerational abuse and hypocrisy that then obviously was then fertile soil for a bunch of baby boomers to say, well, let's just rebel against this completely and flush that whole thing down the drain and go for purity and something more rebellious and good, like Thelema, like do what thou willst shall be my whole of my law now, which became sort of the organizing principle for much of the baby boomer generation, is live in the now. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about the past. Just, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, man. Just let it be.
That's right. No consequences. Because if you can reject the external authority, and you're disconnected from your own sense of responsibility, then there's no consequences for anything. I mean, the real gauge for correct behavior, again, has to be sourced in yourself. You know, visceral level when you're doing wrong. It's a spectrum, but obviously, and if you do loads of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's at the thick end of the spectrum. You feel it. You feel that it's not good for you, right? Hopefully. But it goes all the way to much subtler things. If you tell a lie, you can feel that there's something wrong, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that seems absolutely right. That the abuse of power, and also it was occurring to me in this, that people who assume power over others for their own good, that's a really insidious way for them to actually become less responsible for their own actions, because they can feel like they're good because they're telling others what to do for their good, right? And so there's a mission creep there. That's the absolute power corrupting absolutely. If you're assuming authority over others' lives under the guise of helping them, you're going to probably get further and further from actually checking in with yourself. Am I myself following what is good? Because you've got this show of being good. So yeah, that seems to be what's happening, and that has happened over the generations. But it's also visible in the world, and it also blurs this line that we've been tracing today. That you can't necessarily identify these instruments of evil by their intentions or by their conscious beliefs about what they're doing, because a lot of the time they actually do think they're doing what's good and necessary for others, but they've hopscotched over their own responsibility to check in what's actually good for them.
Do you find Plato has helped you in developing your thinking?
No, he hasn't. Is he a good guy or a bad guy? Because I keep, it's not that I keep flip-flopping, because I don't have a strong thing about Plato anyway. I guess I'll have to read him to make up my own mind. But the number of times that I've sort of had the sense, or even had somebody say, oh, everything started going wrong with Plato and he was the first social engineer and no. But then there are other points of view that actually Plato is one of the good guys. So, you know, But the
Okay.
answer is no. Obviously,
Yeah, I
it's
was curious.
me like the Beatles have influenced everyone, Plato's influenced everyone, right? But I would have to say, as a just at a sort of a very dilettante level, I get the feeling I like Aristotle more because he seemed like he was more kind of down to earth. But
Okay.
it's not really based on it.
I was curious. I was curious.
Right. So has he been a benevolent figure for you, your development then?
Yeah.
Right. Well,
Yeah.
you have to, not that you'd have to convert me or anything, but you'd have to educate me, I think, because,
Yeah, we don't want to do conversions. But no, I'll share some thoughts of some things I've written. I like them. I like them a lot. But yeah, it's interesting. These ideas we what I enjoy is that when reading a lot of his dialogues, that when I'm feeling a little bit down about the stupidity and sophistry prevalent in my society and capacity for self-deception, it can be a little bit heavy sometimes. And so to read Plato's dialogues, I see that a lot of the core ideas, the core problems, the same, even though the details are different, the core lines of reasoning that have br that bring people into states of self-destruction and folly are identical to what was being dealt with by people in ancient Athens, trying to keep Athens from becoming an empire and collapsing into a dark age, as it was understood that that was necessarily going to happen if sophistry was for too long tolerated.
Wow, well, it's certainly tolerated today, isn't
That's the problem. Yeah.
it?
Well, I think you've done and you're doing, I think, with the choices you've made, a really, really good thing by sharing discoveries in the best way that you know how. And I've really gotten a lot out of this conversation, out of your writings. And I would encourage everybody to read your books. The specific articles, your two reviews are going to be easily found in the description box in this under this video, as well as links to your books, your works. Could you tell people where to find your Substack or your website or anything else that I'm missing?
Well, as I said at the beginning, I'm just always moving on, really. But I mean, I do still try to sell books. I would recommend Prisoner Infinity both to you and to the listeners as far as the most comprehensive analysis of the topics we've been talking about specifically today. And then the latest big mother, The Technological Body of Evil, which I say is my last. That's my last book, Mapping Hell. And you can give me a hard time if a year from now I try to bring something else out. I really do feel like, okay, I'm done there. It's gotta be, if you're not persuaded by now, then I just need to give up. Not that I'm trying to persuade people particularly, but anyway, those two books particularly I would recommend. And then my current activity is all on the Children of Job, which I don't know how long it'll stay focused on the Book of Job. As has been pointed out, it's quite a narrow focus. But my idea there was, well, first of all, I think it's good to have a narrow focus in terms of devil is in the details and just, keep it simple. But second of all, the Book of Job is embedded in the Bible, and of course the Bible points to, just about every aspect of culture, as well as what's outside of all of this, which is our relationship with what is outside of space and time and what is eternal. Anyway, that's what I'm embarked on currently, including a weekly Jobcast podcast, which you're welcome to come on if you want to talk about the Bible, or even if you don't. We could continue our chat there. And yeah, otherwise, I mainly, besides looking for new followers on the Substack, I mainly encourage like personal connection, like to. People have any questions or anything they want to share, just to contact me directly at Jason with a U at protonmail.com. I was running online groups, but I haven't done that for a while. And the other thing we haven't got into today, which is the main site is landmademan.com, but nothing goes on there because that's about my land project here, which is working the land and preparing a space for the apocalypse, or at least for tech detox retreats or something for people to come to in difficult times where we're currently perhaps breeding goats. I don't know if they're pregnant or not, but anyway, we have goats and chickens, and we have a vineyard. So I mean, at the very early stages of learning the old ways.
You could clone the goats too, if they don't
Yeah,
breed.
right. Test tube chickens. Yeah, and
Nature grown.
it's in northern Spain, Galicia, and inside the house you can't even get a cell phone signal. There aren't cell phone signals around here. There's no neighbors, barely. It's very much off the map. And it's beautiful, and there's swimming, and there's good weather, and so not that I'm encouraging people to come here, but just that this is my orientation now. This is why I thought I could stop mapping hell, because now I've got to start working out or experiencing how to live in nature or close to nature, which is the least hellish aspect of our temporal existence, even though hell nature is obviously is pretty tough, but at least it doesn't lie to you.
Amen. Well, Jason, this was a pleasure. Really, it was. And send me any of the links that that you mentioned, and I will include everything in the description box. And I look forward to future conversations. And if it happens on your platform for the next one, then that's great too. And yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you also, Matthew. Till next time, then.
Till next time. I can't close it. There it is. Jason. Thanks, man. That really was very, very nice. So, I'm gonna send you a thing on something I wrote. It's actually I'm publishing a book on Saturday tomorrow.
Oh,
It'll be released called
congratulations.
this. Yeah, it's called Science Unshackled. I'll send you a PDF. The first three there's one chapter at the beginning
Yeah.
on my thoughts on Plato. I bring in Aristotle, and it's called "Is the Universe Dead or Alive?" Or animated by death or life, something like that. So I'll send you that.
Yeah.
Take your time, no rush. But
Is
if
that
you
your
have
first
any
book?
feedback, no, it's my ninth book.
Ninth book,
I,
sorry. So
yeah.
a little
Huh? Yeah,
research. I mean, I know you've been very busy because I see you popping up on the internet all the time. And I know you've been doing really good work on the UFO, which hardly anyone is doing, by the way.
it's weird, eh?
Yeah.
It's such a rich topic. That's, oh my God, there's so many discoveries to be made, and people are just, I don't know, they're afraid to let themselves go there. But if you just lean into it, it's
Yeah,
everything. I mean, my
it
God.
it's like it needs rebranding, and because it is so fascinating, but not from a skeptic. From a debunking point of view, and not from obviously from a believer point of view, but this middle way, we're like, yeah,
Yeah.
there's something going on here, but it's extremely dark and manipulative as well as being something else. And it's a key, as we've discussed, it's a key element in how we've been socially engineered.
Yeah. My wife did a really she's helped so much, 'cause she's done a lot of work on the occult, more than I have. So her feedback and help has just been instrumental,
Did
in
she
helping
write
me.
books, or is she behind the woman behind the scenes?
Both.
Okay.
But yeah, she's written her first book called "The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set: On the Birth of International Fascism," which is going to be volume one of three.
Oh my God.
But that's published now, and that's intense. But I think it helped because years ago we were in a political organization in Canada with the Schiller Institute, which had a small outlet up here, and I was a volunteer for about a decade, and we were doing, political organizing. We were doing conferences in Ottawa, talking to different embassies about, the oncoming economic collapse. I don't know if have you looked at the Schiller Institute at all, or Lyndon LaRouche?
Well,
No.
I know who he was, yeah, but Sheila just rings a bell, but I don't know.
It's tied together. That was like a think tank that his wife, LaRouche's wife, created in the 80s. And there's a lot of good ideas on culture and general, peace processes that I liked. I'm not involved with them anymore, but the Canadian operation was very small, but we were doing some very interesting things, and we started finding ourselves targeted for a variety of operations. We're hosting some pretty big conferences in Ottawa. We're getting some of the senators, some elected officials to come to our conferences and listen to various experts describe, you know, policies that could do certain good things. Anyway, I won't go into detail, but we found ourselves all of a sudden getting photographs of all the members, contacts at the grocery store, walking down the street, even in their houses. People would walk by taking pictures and then emailing everybody with weird cryptic messaging. So there was a lot of, it was like a low intensity psychological warfare that was sustained for a period of like 2 years or more. And it had, at first people were just sort of like brushing it off. Nobody's life was being threatened per se, but it did have a deep psychological dissonance, and the group dynamic completely broke down. It was subtle and it was effective. People were accusing everybody of being agents at a certain point. It was crazy. It like, we just saw everything dissolve very effectively. And it was traumatic. It was very traumatic. And she did a deep dive to try to understand some of these techniques. And she spent a lot of time with Schiller, Friedrich Schiller, who I think you would enjoy immensely, the German philosopher and playwright.
He spent time with him.
Yeah, with his mind, you know, his writings. And he did a really wonderful, underappreciated study in 1793 called The Ghost Seer or The Apparitionist. And it's a short story. It was very popular at the time in Germany, but almost impossible to find in our modern day. Barely, I think it was translated a century later into English. A lot of the original American founding fathers were studying this as far as like first, second generation American intelligence, like Samuel Cooper, Edgar Allan Poe was immersed in this study. And it's interesting because what Schiller's doing in this program, it's a story that takes place in Venice. And it's a story of a young German prince who's third away from becoming the actual, you know, it's Germany before the unification, right? So it's a bunch of like different baronials and princelings. And this person is far removed from becoming a leader of his country. But anyway, he's born into privilege. He thinks like a reductionist scientist. So he prides himself as being super smart, but he's not in control fully. He's not fully self-aware of his own weaknesses and his blind spots. And anyway, he finds himself on a vacation in Venice, and he's targeted for a psychological deconstruction in the story. And it's a wonderful insight into how a bunch of mystical experiences are created for him on behalf of Venetian intelligence. Because anybody who knows anything about geopolitics knows that at the time Venice was just, you know, a center of global intelligence. And you know, he quickly finds that he's pulled into a secret society, gambles away his money. So he's stuck there. He discovers that his brother, who's the second in line, dies. And that's forecast by some Armenian soothsayer who told him, in 3 days, you will be dead. And he's like, what do you mean? How did he know in 3 days my brother was going to be dead? There's no way. And so the guy is psychologically deconstructed from being this Protestant German thing. He all of a sudden, by the time the end of the story, he's been there for about 8 months, and he's now a Catholic mystic. He's been deconstructed and reconstructed as a Catholic mystic. And his friend, who was trying to offer him good advice the whole time, saying, hey, man, we've got to get out of here. This is bad. And he's like, no, don't worry. I'm in control. And there is that voice of reason in the form of his friend. And when his friend finally comes back after 4 months, and he just sees him there now as a mystic, but he's now going, now that he's a Catholic mystic, he is now the first in line, and everyone above him is dead. And now he's going to go back and become a stooge of Venetian intelligence as he leads his area of Germany into the 30 Years' War. Cause the thing takes place during the 30 Years' War. Right. And Schiller's trying to get a sense of what type of superstitions amongst the elites were needed to allow for the type of stupid decision-making every step of the way that resulted in a total bloodbath massacre. It could have been, you know, could have gone on more than 30 years. But he's very sensitive to the occult, and these approaches that intelligence agencies have used overlapping with a cult using a sensitivity to the human psyche are exactly what we see being used in the crafting of the UFO mythos.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seemed very germane to what we were talking about today, that example, even with the Catholic mystic conversion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
so,
it's
so the more things change, huh? Except that's fiction, but maybe predictive fiction. What's the name of it?
The Ghost Seer or The Apparitionist is the secondary title.
Is it a full-length novel or just a story?
It's a long story, maybe 90 pages or so.
Novella. Right.
My wife did an essay, a deep dive on it with a class. I'll send you a link to her her write-up.
Okay. Yeah. Which part of Canada, by the way, just quickly?
We just bought a little house in farmland south of Montreal.
I figured somehow you were over there, because we used to live in British Columbia. I don't know if you knew.
But oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we escaped, just not that I knew exactly what was coming down with COVID, but I moved to Spain at the end of 2020. So before it got really bad there. But yeah, we were there. I was there for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
I go back and forth every year. That's that's interesting. In Vancouver or
Hope. You probably drive through where we're.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Hope. Yeah.
Oh wow. Huh.
We had
interesting.
A thrift store there.
Oh okay. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so now that you're in Spain, you have a like you said you have I don't know what you would call it. It's sort of like a safe haven. You've created like it's a big property of an acre.
Well, it's a big land.
Or?
Yeah, no, it's 7 acres,
okay.
And then we have a big house. I mean, it's that we could put up half a dozen people here if we reorganize things, and a little house that we're getting ready that a couple could live in, and then a little cabin on the vineyard that a couple could live in. So yeah, basically we could, you know, if push came to shove or the crunch came. We could certainly provide refuge to a dozen people if it comes to that. Yeah. It looked like it was coming to that a year or two ago, but now we were in the lull after the storm currently.
Well, I'm thinking that the storm is coming back again, bigger than ever. So it's good that you set this up. I mean, I'm looking at the situation in the Middle East now, and in many ways, it's even tied to the. There's some weird connections to the UFO story as well. Yeah. If you look at the founders of Christian Zionism, the radical political Zionist movements of British intelligence, and Lord Shaftesbury and Palmerston, and the whole like Derbyite network of Plymouth Brethren.
I don't know how you hold all this stuff in your head at the same time, but
I'm sure same can be said for you, man. We care about the story.
I suppose, but I get the feeling that you have a more, like I tend to forget all the actual names and dates after I've written books. So. But
well, I think for me, it's just that I have to talk about it a lot. So it's like, I'm always doing the podcast interview circuit on geopolitics. So it's like, I guess that necessity causes me to have to revisit these things more in some ways, but then I also have big blind spots too. And I forget all sorts of things. Like, my wife could tell you, I've got like one of the least functional memories. It's ridiculous.
Hard to believe, but okay. Yeah.
No, it's okay for theory and like geopolitical stuff, but like where I put the anyway. Like I don't even know where my snow tires are, but that's the side note.
Oh well, that's that being said, another part of the brain, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. Anyway, I'll send you some stuff. And I'll let you know when this goes up online. And if you would like to do a chat at any time, let me know on your podcast. And happily,
I'll send you a blog in the next few weeks for sure. Now that we've touched base, and maybe we can do a follow up to this at some point, because there's so much to get into I didn't even think of that. Because you're in Big Mother. As briefly because of Teilhard de Chardin, and that's a whole connection with Catholicism, transhumanism.
Yeah.
So this is a huge.
Okay, well maybe we'll make that one. Maybe just I don't have your big mother, but I think you sent me the PDF. Was it that?
I sent you the Prisoner of Infinity PDF. I can send, I can have the publishers send you a hard copy of Big Mother because it's just come out.
Okay, or if you have a PDF, or I'll just order it. I should just order it, frankly. And I'll direct me to whatever relevant chapters I should start with, maybe for that conversation, or on that'll touch on. Or if I should just read the whole thing, I'll just read the whole thing. I could do that. I'll read the whole thing.
Yeah, you can find time. Don't rush anything. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll take our time. You know, the apocalypse, it keeps getting postponed, so it might
have. Yeah. Well, you know, there's that Chinese proverb, when's the best time to plant a tree 20 years ago? When's the second best time today?
Today. So. Yeah, but if you're Mexican, it's tomorrow.
After the siesta. All right, man.
Okay.
I'll talk to you later. See ya.